and I think there is no better test than fasting insulin. I simply do not understand why more physicians do not order fasting insulin. Now I can say F you to Big Pharma. Check out this review on gut and digestion from Heart and Soil Supplements. I've had Crohn's disease for 10 years now, since I was 15. I've been on and off all kinds of meds to treat it. I eventually was put on Humira, told I needed to stay on it. This did not sit well with me, and I got off it recently due to immune system suppression concerns. Shortly after that, I got on gut and digestion pills from Heart and Soil Supplements, and I regulated my diet to an animal-based diet. It has now been 3 years since then. I've not had any issues or flares. These have allowed me to say F you to Big Pharma and to take health into my own hands. Thank you so much, Dr. Saladino and Heart and Soil. You've changed my life and are truly doing good in the world. That kind of stuff makes me so happy. Gut and Digestion is an amazing supplement we make at Heart and Soil Supplements. It contains grass-fed tripe and intestine, so stomach and intestine, pancreas, liver, and spleen. All of our organs are grass-fed and grass-finished. It's in a glass bottle because plastic is bullshit. And this is the finest desiccated organ supplement you can find on the planet. It's so interesting to see that organs do support the like organs, and people with GI issues generally very often do find benefit from desiccated tripe and intestine. And that's much easier than eating the fresh stuff. So you can find us at heartandsoil.co. On this week's podcast, I break down my latest set of blood work from March 2023, and I give you an idea of which labs to order and how to read your own blood work. I'm going to go much more deep on blood work than most people will, and I'm going to talk about specific ratios like cortisol to DHEAS, talk about PTH, prolactin, sex hormone binding globulin, give you guys an update on my iron situation. I've been doing phlebotomy. Did my sex hormone binding globulin go down? How has it affected my hormones? What's my hematocrit? I'm going to talk about all that stuff. And the single most important lab for you to order every time you get blood work, it's all in this podcast. Enjoy this one. I think it'll be very technical at times, but also very informational. And you will get a lot out of it when you do your own blood work and you want to understand how to interpret that. I hope these tools equip you and make you curious and allow you to take control of your own health and be independent and have your own agency, which is what this is all about. I want to say thank you to my sponsors who make this podcast possible. This podcast is free of charge, but I am happy to, and I am grateful to be able to share this information in this fashion. So thank you to, let's start with Earth Runners. You can go to earthrunners.com to check this stuff out. You can use the code carnivore to get 10% off. If you don't know about Earth Runners, they're pretty cool. They're modeled after this ancestral version of a sandal called a Huarache sandal. But Earth Runners are even more cool than that. They're definitely minimalist, super flexible, allow your feet to expand and all of the little muscles in your feet to get strong, but they have an earthing plug and conductive laces to keep you grounded to the earth, even when you're wearing shoes. I could have used something like this recently when I was in New York City. It's basically impossible there to walk around barefoot, though I did stick my feet in the Hudson River a few times. Maybe it was the East River. I don't know. I can't keep them all straight. They're both gross. But you could walk around on grass in Central Park in New York City with Earth Runners and actually be grounded to the earth. Or you can walk around on a field near your house if you don't want to go barefoot. You could walk on the beach. You could walk anywhere that's in contact with the earth with these on, and you're still going to be grounded. So if you're doing a hike, you'll be grounded for the whole hike with Earth Runners, and you'll have some protection on the bottom of your feet so you don't step on glass, pebbles, whatever kind of hazards might be in your path. So I really appreciate what they're doing here. Our ancestors were always connected with the earth. Check them out at earthrunners.com, spelled exactly like it sounds, and use the code carnivore for 10% off your order of a new pair of Earth Runner sandals. Got to give a shout out to my friends at 8sleep.com, EIGHTSLEEP.com. So one of the things that I hate about mattresses when I'm traveling is that they're hot and they're low quality, meaning that I always sweat in them because they don't breathe real well. And they're just kind of, I feel like I'm sleeping on just like a bowl of spaghetti. And you guys know I don't even like spaghetti. So why would I want to sleep in a bowl of like mushy spaghetti? I need something that's actually supportive and cooling. And that's a big part of us falling asleep, is cooling our body temperature. So I'm excited that this episode is brought to you by 8Sleep. They make something called the Pod Pro Cover. It fits on any bed like a fitted sheet, and it improves your sleep by automatically adjusting the temperature of each side of the bed based on you and your partner's individual needs. It can cool down and warm up, and it adjusts based on the phases of your sleep. and the environment that you're in. This is like AI for your bed, guys. So I really appreciated putting one of these on my mattress in Austin. It has biometric scanning, and so it'll tell you your HRV in the morning. You can adjust each side of the bed individually. So if there's somebody in the other side of the bed with me, so that if there's someone on the other side of the bed with you, you can make your side different temperature than that one. And I woke up in the morning when I had this feeling extremely refreshed. It was really, really high quality sleep. So I've really never experienced sleep like this. And I think it's very worth your investment in the sleep you deserve with an 8 Sleep Pod Pro. So you can go to 8sleep.com, EIGHTSLEEP.com/carnivoreND and save $150 on the pod cover by 8 Sleep. That's the best offer you'll find, but you must visit 8sleep.com/carnivoreMD for $150 off 8 Sleep. And they currently ship within the US, Canada, the UK, and select countries in the European Union and Australia. I want to give a shout out to my friends at Zero Acre as well. You guys may have heard the previous podcast that I did with Jeff Knobs and Tucker Goodrich. Seed oils are something I detest. I talk about seed oils, polyunsaturated fats, and the problems with them from multiple perspectives in this episode. So one of the cool things about Zero Acre is that they've figured out a way to make cultured oil, which means they can make an oil that has very, very low amount of linoleic acid in it and is much richer in other fats like monounsaturated fats like oleic acid, which is generally found in higher amounts in olive oil. So I'm super excited about what they're doing. And they make a very light tasting oil that is great for frying, roasting, sauteing, stir frying, baking, dressing, drizzling. And I'm excited to see this oil in more restaurants and more places where they're using this. If you are using an oil that you are drizzling or pouring over your food, you should check out Zero Acre. It is gluten-free, vegan, glyphosate residue-free, allergen certified, allergen friendly, and Whole 30 approved. It comes in an infinitely recyclable aluminum packaging, which completely blocks UV light, preventing oxidation. So it's a cultured oil, which is pretty cool because it's not a derivative of a different type of oil, but it's a new type of oil made through fermentation. It's very energy efficient. And there are many companies, including Chipotle, that have made investments in Zero Acre. I would love to see Zero Acre replace the rice bran oil they're currently using at Chipotle. So you can head over to zeroacre.com. That's ZEROACRE.com for an exclusive offer. Use the code Paul at checkout to claim the deal. It's ZEROACRE.com/Paul. And last but not least, got to give a shout out to my friends at Bond Charge. Bond Charge is BONCHARGE, like good energy, bondcharge.com. As I am recording this podcast and this intro, my computer is on an EMF blocking mat. And if you are putting a laptop on your lap, you might want to check out these EMF blocking mats. I got one for one of the guys on my team who's always working with his laptop on his lap. There's a lot of radiation from your laptop going into your genitals, whether they're ovaries or testicles. You should protect them. So I love their EMF blocking mats. I'm also not a big fan of AirPods, guys. I know it's going to break your heart, but I really appreciate that Bond Charge also makes EMF reducing headphones, which are like earbuds, but they're wired and they're much lower EMF than anything like an AirPod. I would not put AirPods in your ear. Wired headphones are coming back in vogue anyway. So check out what they're making at Bond Charge to protect yourself from EMF in so many different ways. I've got the laptop mat. I've got the earbuds. They do great stuff. You can find them at bondcharge.com. Use the coupon code CarnivoreMD to save 15%. Bondcharge.com, BONCHARGE.com. CarnivoreMD will save you 15%. On to the podcast, my friends. Welcome to the third installment of my blood work in the last 6 to 7 months. In this podcast, I wanted to go over which blood work you might consider ordering on your own or with your physician who is willing to do blood work with you for you, and how to think about that blood work, how to interpret that blood work. I think that blood work is a fascinating lens into what is going on in your body. And it's not a perfect microscope of how healthy you are, but as I will talk about in this podcast and reference some previous podcasts, like last week's podcast with Georgi Dinkov, where we talk about the cortisol to DHEA or DHES ratio, there are some pretty telling labs you can get that are not often thought about or ordered by mainstream physicians. And so there, I believe that And so I believe that a lot of us and a lot of physicians are leaving a lot of information about our health, about our current state of stress versus not stress, our current state of longevity projection, perhaps, if we want to go into that murky voodoo realm, our current state of overall vitality is perhaps the best word. We're leaving that on the table by not checking some of these labs. So this is, like I said, the third episode in which I've talked about my blood work. This is blood work from March of 2023. I did previous episodes, August 2022 and November 2022. And this is in an effort to continue to open the kimono, as it were, and show you all what my blood work looks like as a 45-year-old male taking no drugs, no hormones, no supplements. I use heart and soil desiccated organs, but I don't think of those as supplements as much as they are just desiccated organs in a capsule. So if you think that's a supplement, then fine. It's a supplement. I end up taking beef organs and whole package throughout the week when I can't get enough fresh organs or if I want some of the organs I'm not getting enough of. But that's all to say that you all know my diet for the most part. I've done many videos about what I eat in a day. I have meat, grass-fed beef, maybe a pound to a pound and a half a day. It varies from day to day. I have lots of raw dairy. I have raw goat's milk right now, raw yogurt, raw kefir, and I have fruit. In Costa Rica, I'm getting lots of mangoes, papaya, watermelon, oranges. I make orange juice. I do local raw honey, which is glyphosate-free. I have a low microplastic sea salt, and that's basically my diet. Most of what I drink is coconut water. And if you look at the previous videos I've done on what I eat in a day and putting that through chronometer, you can see where the nutrients are that I'm eating. And you can see the balance of saturated fat, monounsaturated fat, polyunsaturated fat. Obviously, the latter are quite low. You can see the amount of calories I get is probably over 3,000 a day, sometimes 3,500. And the amount of carbohydrates I'm getting every day is significant, probably 200 to 350 grams of carbohydrates a day, mostly in the form of simple sugars like lactose in milk, lactose in cheese, although a lot of that is fermented out. I do eat cheese. I forgot about that earlier. And fructose, glucose, in sucrose, in honey, and fruit juice. So two podcasts ago, I had a little bit of a friendly debate with Dave Asprey about fructose. I talked about this with Georgie Dinkov on last week's podcast. And I want to show you guys how my blood work looks eating 200 to 350 grams of carbohydrates a day, mostly from milk, honey, fruit. Do I have non-alcoholic fatty liver disease? Do I have elevated liver enzymes? I'll get into all of that in this podcast. Do I have an elevated uric acid? Obviously, a little bit of foreshadowing here, and the answer to all of those is no. And I'm willing to do a liver ultrasound to prove that, but you'll see that in this podcast. And I'll go over some data suggesting that fructose is not the cause of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And I'll talk about what I really believe is. There won't be many surprises here if you're familiar with my content and you listen to what I'm talking about on a regular basis. So again, this is not to be medical advice. This isn't to substitute for anything that you're going to talk about with your doctor. I am a doctor. I'm a double board certified medical doctor, but I think about things differently than most mainstream physicians, which is why it's fun to get to do what I do. I want this to be educational. I want it to make you curious. And hopefully in the future, there will be some way to enable actual healthy debate with some of the people in the health space whose opinions might differ from mine on this blood work, on health metrics, and how we become healthy as humans. And I'll refer to that throughout the podcast. So with that intro, let's get into my recent blood work from March, and we'll go from there. So as we go through this, I will show on the screen share, which is going to be on YouTube and Spotify now as a video platform, my blood work. And I'm showing you the actual unadulterated blood work from LabCorp, where I got it. I did this blood work through Merrick Health. They're a sponsor of the podcast. I think they're great, and they've been helpful to me in just ordering whatever blood work I want to get on my own. So that's what we'll do. And at the end of the podcast, I will sort of run through all of the blood work I've done. So you can save that part, re-listen to it, write it down. Well, maybe we'll put it in the show notes. We'll transcribe that part so you can look and get a list of all the things that I do. Now, to be fair, this blood work panel is fairly comprehensive. And you may not need something that is quite this comprehensive if you have different goals in mind. But when I do blood work on myself, I want to get as much as possible. And I find it quite fascinating to really dig into all of this. So let's start with two blood tests that I think are some of the most important that you can do that are very rarely done by mainstream physicians. This is the fasting insulin and the prolactin. And as you can see here, I am a 45-year-old male. I was born June 29th, 1977. That's me. This is my blood work. So my insulin, my fasting insulin was 3.2 micro IU per ml. on this blood work, which was in mid-March 2023, and my prolactin was 10.5. Now, for context, usually almost every single time that I've done fasting insulin, it's right around 3 micro IU per ml or lower. But I did have previous blood work on the 6th of March, which is why I repeated this one, where I had a 5.8 out of nowhere. So I don't know why my fasting insulin was up on the 6th of March. I don't really vary my diet that much. But this is just to say that if your blood work looks a little funny, just repeat it. Sometimes things are strange in what we're doing. The body is complex and we can't always go based on one snapshot. I'll talk about that with regard to lipids later in this podcast as well. So this is an outlying value for me, a 5.8. Is it a lab error? Was I just more tired? I was traveling for all of this blood work, so it's influenced by that. I'm not sleeping in the same bed that I'm used to in Costa Rica, which is where I spend most of my time. And I'm frankly not my best self when I'm traveling because I'm not in my space. I'm exposed to lights at night. My circadian rhythm is off. I'm moving across time zones. So take that into consideration when we're looking at these labs. But regardless, one of these fasting insulin levels was not horrible. 5.8 is not horrible. But if somebody came to me with a fasting insulin of 5.8, I'd say, well, it's a little higher than I'd like to see it. So I repeated it, 3.2, which is more like what I'm used to seeing. You'll see here my prolactin was 11.8 on the 6th of March. Again, I think that on the 6th of March, I just really hadn't slept well the night before. Prolactin tends to be a little bit elevated when you haven't slept well, when you are fatigued. And even this 10.5 from this mid-March blood work. So I got blood work on the 6th of March and probably on the 15th or something of March. And this 10.5 for prolactin is also high for me. I've had prolactins in the 7s before, which is probably more of my normal. Why do I care about prolactin? Prolactin is important when you're thinking about dopamine and when you're thinking about testosterone. I had a friend recently who sent me his blood work and his prolactin was 34. And I thought, you need to work that up. You need to look and see if you have a little adenoma in your brain. That's not a normal level of prolactin in the human body, especially for a male or any woman who is not breastfeeding. So prolactin is something that can interfere with sex drive, with erectile function, with weight loss, with libido, all of these things. And so you want to know what your prolactin is, and it should kind of track with metabolic health. The thing to know about prolactin also is that it is elevated after an orgasm. So if you've had sex or an orgasm the night before you get your blood work, it might be a little higher. But in metabolically healthy males specifically, there should be a quick return to baseline of prolactin after orgasm. I imagine it's the same for women. We can look into that data on a future podcast as well. So start your blood work with a fasting insulin and a prolactin. Make sure you get those two, know what levels are normal for you. You definitely want your prolactin, I would say, less than 15, which is the reference interval, and I would say probably less than 10. And understand, like I said, that if you are very tired, fatigued, or had sex right before this test, it might not be a totally accurate measure of things. But if your prolactin is in the 30s or in the 20s or in the high teens, something is off there and you need to dig into that. And if your insulin is really much above 4 or 5, then you need to think about what is causing insulin resistance. And a theme throughout this podcast on blood work, and as I talk about blood work in general and health of humans in general, will be that there is no greater metric to understand than your insulin sensitivity. And I think there is no better test than fasting insulin. I simply do not understand why more physicians do not order fasting insulin, probably because as doctors, we are taught only really to think about that test in the setting of type 1 diabetes. But this, as I've said before, and I will say again, I think if more people ordered fasting insulin, if more physicians ordered fasting insulin, more nurse practitioners, more PAs, and more patients were empowered to ask their physicians for fasting insulin, it would change the face of medicine because we would see how many people have elevated fasting insulin. They have subclinical insulin resistance, subclinical metabolic dysfunction, and then you can start taking action on that. I'll talk in this podcast about what you can do to take action regarding that. Cliff notes, it doesn't have to do with removing sugar from your diet in the form of fruit and honey. I think that's actually not a problem for humans, though that's a controversial view. I've spoken about it in the past. Last week's podcast with Georgie had some information about that as well. The major thing I think you need to do, the two major things you need to do if you have an elevated fasting insulin is think about your baseline cortisol levels, and I'll show you my cortisol to DHEA in one moment. And what is raising your cortisol? Is it leaky gut? Is it gut inflammation causing cortisol to be elevated because of this fragment of gram-negative bacteria called lipopolysaccharide or endotoxin that's moving into your body? And limit your consumption, your intake of omega-6 primarily, but also don't overdo omega-3 polyunsaturated fatty acids. I think those are the two main drivers of insulin resistance in humans. So you want to know what your cortisol is, and let's go to that. So you can see here from, this is from March the 6th, blood work, my morning cortisol was 15.8. Again, previously my morning cortisol was 10.0. This is probably some indication of poor sleep as I'm traveling, but my DHEAS is 126 and previously 139 micrograms per deciliter. So this ratio, cortisol to DHEAS, is perhaps the single easiest but also most powerful ratio to assess how stressed you are and to potentially assess your longevity or the trajectory that you are headed toward in your longevity. What do you want this ratio to be? Less than 0.3. You can see that even in my stressed state with poor sleep, my ratio is 0.124. So I'm not in a bad spot. And the ratio was even lower when I was perhaps a little better slept in November, 10 over 139. Both of these are the same units, micrograms per deciliter. So understand what your cortisol is. Get an AM cortisol. These are both AM fasting cortisols. And if you are really interested in knowing where your cortisol level is, get it throughout the day, because understanding your cortisol will give you many insights into your overall health and could help you unravel, untangle what is causing both non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, to foreshadow something I'll talk about later in this podcast, and your overall stress and insulin resistance. So again, let's repeat this. If your fasting insulin is elevated, limit polyunsaturated fatty acids, that is seed oils, corn, canola, sunflower, safflower, grapeseed. I've talked about this tons on previous podcasts and on my social media. And manage your cortisol. Get that as low as possible. Is it stress reduction? Is it improving your sleep quality? Whatever you need to do, think about what's raising your cortisol. Is it damage to your gut causing, again, endotoxin, this fragment of gram-negative bacterial cell walls? When the gram-negative bacteria proliferate in the colon, this seems to happen. Talked about with Georgie last week. So cortisol to DHEAS ratio, less than 0.3. Again, mine is about 1.24 here, and even lower than that on my previous labs. So that makes me think, okay, great. I'm doing good from that perspective in terms of longevity. Let me show you a study that will put this in context. So this is one of the better studies I could find regarding the cortisol DHEA sulfate ratio. Title is Cortisol DHEA Sulfate, Their Ratio and All-Cause and Cause-Specific Mortality in the Vietnam Experience Study. You can see in the conclusions, DHEAS, dehydroepiandrosterone sulfate, which is a storage form of DHEA, negatively associated, and the ratio of cortisol to DHEA was positively associated with all-cause cancer and other medical cause mortality. So what does that mean? It means that the higher your DHEAS, the lower your associated risk of all-cause mortality, cancer mortality, and other medical cause mortality. And this means that the lower your ratio of cortisol to DHEAS, again, the lower the all-cause cancer and other medical cause mortality was. So powerful ratio that is very rarely discussed by physicians, cortisol to DHEAS ratio. So what it suggests, and if you look at that study, they will also argue for something less than 0.5, maybe even 0.3, is that if you have a cortisol to DHEAS ratio that is less than 0.3, your risk of all-cause mortality, cancer mortality, cause-specific mortality is lower than someone that has a higher ratio of those things. What do you do to correct that? You do all of the things that I've talked about in the past. Focus on sleep, stress reduction, lower your cortisol, eat nutrient-rich foods. I'm a huge fan of animal meat and organs. You all know this. To support the production of DHEAS, one of these androgenic substances in the human body. So this is basically a ratio that looks at the amount of stress you have to the amount of sex hormone, one of the sex hormones in your body. So when you are stressed, your cortisol goes up. We know that ketogenic diets raise cortisol. Ketogenic diets shift the precursor enzymatic systems, 11 beta hydroxysteroid dehydrogenase, toward a phenotype that makes more cortisol and its precursors in humans. And so when you're stressed, you have more cortisol and you have less of the sex hormones. So the sex hormones are the other side of the equation. This is a balance here. It says, am I stressed? Is now a good time to make babies? And for most of us, throughout our lives, it's a good time to make babies. You want to be vital throughout your life. Even if you are past menopause, even if you are past the time of having babies, I'm saying this as a sort of metaphor. You want to be vital. Vitality is reflected in robust amounts of sex hormones, androgens for both men and women, DHEAS being one of those. I'll show you my testosterone and my sex hormones in one moment, and we'll segue into those. But this is sort of the balance. Is it, am I stressed? Or is it time to be fertile, to be vital, even if you're past menopause, et cetera? You guys get what I'm saying. So this is scarcity is cortisol versus abundance, DHEAS. And like I said, throughout our lives, we want abundance over scarcity. Now, I know some people will say, isn't it good to have scarcity sometimes? No, I disagree with that. It's a subject for a different podcast. You don't want cortisol to be high, really, ever in your life. It's impossible to avoid that. You will have tragedy. You will have stress. You'll have a car accident. Hopefully it's not a bad one. You'll have a fender bender. There will be stressful things in your life. You will travel across time zones like I was. You will have poor sleep. But in general, I don't believe there's any situations for humans in which we want cortisol to be high. There's probably a future set of podcasts on the way we have misconceptualized stress and the flawed reasoning around hormesis, this concept that a little bit of a poison is good for you. And that is for the future. But suffice it to say that I find myself more and more in the camp of Hans Selye and other sort of historical philosophers in the medical space saying that stress is cumulative and stress is not a good thing for humans. I don't believe ketogenic diets are good really ever. There are perhaps a few situations where they are useful in the short term. Georgie and I have talked about that in the past on previous podcasts. I'm just thinking of that specifically where you could remove all of the food from your diet or some of the fiber-containing foods or fasting could be a ketogenic source of physiology, but that is going to rest the colon and decrease endotoxin. So if a ketogenic diet removes foods that are increasing endotoxin, like high fiber foods or foods that were problematic for humans, like grains or beans that were probably increasing endotoxin by causing damage to the gut, specifically the large intestine, that is a step in the right direction. But I think carbohydrates are this signal of abundance for humans. More to come on that later in this podcast. And I know that that's going to be hard for many of you to wrap your head around, but I would encourage you to stay curious and stay open because the literature really does have many articles, many experiments that are in support of that view. And if you look at things like your cortisol to DHEAS ratio, if you look at your sex hormones, I think you will see, and that in addition to other things like fasting insulin and CRP and other things, you could even look at things like MGO, methylglyoxal, metrics that overall your blood work and your physiology is going to be better when you are eating carbohydrates. So bookmark this fructose and NAFLD conversation for later in this podcast. And let's talk about my sex hormones, my testosterone. So you can see here that my testosterone on this test was 819 nanograms per deciliter. Free testosterone is 1.5%. That's generally where I am. I had a blood work test a few months ago where it was much higher at 3. I'm not sure why it was quite that high. And then my free testosterone is 123, which is right in the middle of the reference range. So as a reminder, I'm 45 years old. I take no hormonal supplementation. I've never taken TRT. If anyone tells you that as a 40-year-old man or a 40-year-old or a 50-year-old man or woman, your androgens, and androgens are important for women too, that these are just going to decline with age, you call bullshit because this is not true. I've seen this over and over. I've worked with people specifically. I had a previous client text me the other day and say that his 71.5-year-old testosterone was 820 or something, essentially the same as mine. So he's 72 almost, and he has the same testosterone as mine. So if you believe that testosterone declines with age as a man, you're sort of being fed this BS narrative. And I don't know what his free testosterone was off the top of my head, but we could look into that. So my testosterone has consistently been 700 to 800 with zero supplementation. I don't do any weird herbs or things that are going to have funny side effects. I eat meat, I eat organs, I eat fruit, I eat honey, and it's fine. And I don't have insulin resistance, as I showed you with my fasting insulin. And as I'll show you with my liver tests, I don't have any indications of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And there's actually no good evidence that fructose leads to non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And as I'll show you, there is very compelling evidence that significant amounts of simple sugars will increase testosterone, sperm motility, testicular volume in human males. So that's to say, again, back to the equation that I was talking about. On one side of the equation, you have cortisol, which is scarcity and stress. On the other side, you have DHEAS, which is vitality, libido, fertility, and The way that you support fertility is by giving your body enough carbohydrates. So I'll get to that in a moment. But one thing that I want to talk about that's interesting with my testosterone is the sex hormone binding globulin. If you guys are familiar with my history and in connection with iron, you'll understand the story. But if you're not, I will tell the story quickly. So the basic gist here is that my sex hormone binding globulin, which is a protein in the human blood like albumin that carries our sex hormones, has been elevated for a long time. And when I was on keto, my SHBG was in the 120s at one time. So low carb appears to raise SHBG. This is an argument that I've advanced in the past that is probably that ketogenic low carb diets are not great for sex hormones, because when you have more SHBG, you're going to have less free hormones in your body. And so I was wondering, why is my SHBG so high? I experimented with things like boron, didn't really change anything, and I'm not sure that's the right solution either. I think I'm getting plenty of boron in my diet. I stumbled upon this idea that perhaps my SHBG was elevated because perhaps I had a little bit too much iron in my blood. As I've talked about in the past, I don't have hemochromatosis. I don't have genes for hemochromatosis. I've shown my genes on previous podcasts, but I do seem to hold on to iron when I eat meat every day. And to be fair, this is a reason that some people may argue, Paul, isn't this an impetus to eat less red meat with all of this bioavailable heme iron? And I don't really think it is, because here's the short answer. I think red meat, especially grass-fed red meat, is probably the most evolutionarily consistent food we could eat because it's fed the most ancestrally evolutionarily consistent diet. Cows are fed grass throughout their lives, and that grass is what they're supposed to be eating. I don't really want to eat lower iron-containing chicken that is fed corn and soy and grains. If I eat the dark meat, I'm going to get a similar amount of heme iron as I am with red meat. If I eat darker pork, I'm going to get that. But both pork and chicken are fed corn and soy, and I don't want to eat those foods. I would rather eat red meat and then understand where my iron is and manage it. How do I manage it? Well, this may sound a little intense, but I've been doing phlebotomy. So this means I essentially drain a little bit of blood every week. And if you've heard my previous podcasts, what have I started doing? Yeah, I do my own blood draws. So every week, I stick a needle in my vein, usually right there, and I drain out 50 to 60 cc's of blood, which I then give to that plant behind me, which is maybe why it looks so healthy. And as you can see, my ferritin, I'll show you the ferritin levels, have gone down significantly with that process. And interestingly, and this is really the first time that I'm able to share this on blood work, my SHBG has now also gone down to the lowest levels that I've had, perhaps since I've been checking it in the last 4 to 5 years. So I really think that there is interesting evidence in the medical literature that subclinical iron overload may lead to levels of sex hormone binding globulin that are higher than we want to see it. So let's get into the details of all that, and I'll show you guys how it all shakes out. So you can see here that on these most recent labs in March 2023, my ferritin is now 87, previously 252. And before 252, it was above 300. So 300 doesn't really raise the alarm. You can see here that the reference interval for ferritin is 30 to 400 nanograms per ml. But for me, it seems that things are better in my physiology when my ferritin is a little lower. Perhaps my ancestors just didn't have quite as much access to red meat as I did. And so when they got iron, they wanted to really hold on to it because it's such a precious nutrient. Iron forms the center of every hemoglobin molecule in your body, which is the large complex of proteins in all of your red blood cells that carry oxygen. That's a pretty central thing for being a healthy human. So if you perhaps didn't have access to lots of iron in the past, half of my ancestry is Sicilian, then holding on to iron may have been a good thing. So I realized that as we move through time and space in 2023, we may do things differently than our ancestors had. And I'm trying to do that in the best way possible, eating the cleanest, most nutrient-rich foods, but also mitigating potential issues with genetics that may not be ideal. Now, hundreds of years ago, my ancestors might have been eating more fish. Maybe they were eating more land animals like chicken or pork, and they may have had less iron in their diets. If those animals were not fed suboptimal foods, maybe that would be something that I could consider and experiment with. But I feel pretty darn good with meat and organs. I just do this phlebotomy to manage my ferritin. So it's an interesting thing. It's humbling for me to say, oh, I don't think this is a reason for humans not to eat good quality red meat, grass-fed, grass-finished, but I think it's something to know and you should check your iron stores. You can see here the whole iron panel you want is going to have the iron binding capacity, which is called the TIBC, serum iron, and iron saturation, which is 35, previously 31. I've had that as high as almost 50 in the past. So you want that iron saturation below 40 for sure. You want that ferritin. I would say the ferritin can go even lower for me, probably 60 or 70 or even 50. And those are the main iron stores. Those are the main iron metrics that you want to get on your labs. You'll see here on the blood work that my B12 is out of the reference range, but this is a normal thing for me. And it happens for many humans who are eating red meat and organs, animal foods that has lots of B12. That's nothing to be concerned about. There is some association in the literature. There are some conditions where people have myeloid dysplasia or blood cancers that lead to elevated B12, but you can easily see on a CBC that I don't have any blood cancer. This is just an elevated storage amount of B12, which is completely safe from everything we know in medicine and not an issue. You can see my folate is 6.7, previously 15.7. Not sure why it's lower, but it's still within the reference range. And I am eating a little more liver now, which is good, as you'll see later on my homocysteine. So we can also look then at my sex hormone binding globulin. SHBG is here, 50.2, previously 69.5 in November. So this is November to March with basically weekly phlebotomy, 50 to 60 cc's of blood led to a drop in the SHBG, probably between 69.5 and 50.2 with a ferritin that went down from 252 to 87. So I'll keep an eye on this, but I think that's really interesting. And obviously, this isn't a perfect experiment. There's no way I could blind myself, but I do think that I feel better with less iron. I feel better with probably a lower ferritin now. And perhaps the sex drive is a little better for me with less ferritin, though the testosterone has remained about the same. You'll notice here that this blood work is from the 6th of March. Like I said, I did blood work maybe about a week later, and that was the 812 testosterone that I showed you. On this one, my testosterone was 738. So this is, again, just to say that your testosterone can vary day to day a pretty significant amount without much change in diet or anything major there. So here's my DHEA on this lab, 126, and my cortisol, we talked about that. Let's talk about my other sex hormones here, and then I'll go through the rest of the labs. You can see my estradiol is 20.8. My progesterone is 0.1. My DHT is 46 with the DHT percent free 0.77 and the DHT free 3.54. So DHT, dihydrotestosterone, is perhaps the most potent androgen that we make in our bodies. And I haven't done this test before, so I don't really have any baseline to compare it to. Often the best thing that you can do with yourself in the blood work is to get a baseline and then compare it on future labs. So it'll be interesting to see where my DHT goes for future labs. I don't take any finasteride or anything for my hair. This is just all my hair for real. And I do believe that these 5-alpha reductase blockers are a problematic thing for humans. There's even a whole medical syndrome called post-finasteride syndrome. So I did a previous podcast a while ago on hair loss and how to combat that. I think that the high level there is make sure you're getting enough nutrients and be aware that you could be losing hair from an autoimmune perspective, in which case an elimination diet, like an animal-based diet of organs, meat, fruit, honey, and raw dairy could be very helpful. And there's also a scalp massage protocol and other things you can do to help with your hair loss. Interestingly, I just met a girl at the farmer's market here the other day who said that her acne got significantly better when she went to an animal-based diet. I think that this is why these type of diets are so powerful for humans. A diet that's basically meat and fruit, I think you get the best of both worlds. You get nutrient-rich meat and organs, either fresh or desiccated, like hardened soil supplements. And then you're getting carbohydrates from fruit, which I believe is the least toxic way to get your carbohydrates, and honey. And then you can build on that, adding things back in gradually when you have resolution or improvement in what you're looking for. A woman with acne is not terribly related to someone losing their hair, but both of those can be autoimmune conditions. And I think that I will do a podcast in the future with a specific woman who's here in Costa Rica, who you guys may know, Shannon. She's an incredible contortionist. And she has a story of improving her acne with an animal-based diet as well. So if you have acne, if you have autoimmune hair loss, if you have any autoimmune disease, considering a simplified diet of meat and organs, this is essentially animal-based when you add the fruit and honey, I think is a great way to combat your autoimmune conditions. If you're curious how much I'd recommend for macros, that is the protein, the fat, and the carbohydrates for you, there's a free calculator at my website, which is carnivoremd.com. www.bodybuilding.com. And you can see based on your weight and your activity level, where you might put your carbohydrates, your protein, and your fat for your body type, and give you at least an overview of where you could structure your diet in terms of animal-based foods, organs, meat, fruit, honey, and raw dairy. Heart and Soil Supplements does an animal-based 30 challenge a few times a year. There might be one coming up in quarter two. The website for that is animalbased30.com. And once you do that, and if you do that, you will get lots of hand-holding and very specific attention into creating an animal-based diet, which I think could be very helpful for many of you as well. I wanted to talk a little bit about this idea of testosterone and how you can hurt it and how you can improve it. So I don't find much of this that surprising, but there is good evidence that things like soy probably lower testosterone, flaxseed with its lignans, which are phytoestrogens, lower testosterone. There's evidence that nuts can lower testosterone. There's evidence that things like spearmint and mint can lower testosterone. So if your testosterone is not where you want it, consider that many foods that I don't think are awesome for humans, nuts, seeds, grains, beans, seeds like flaxseed, mint is a leaf, often have anti-androgenic mechanisms. I'll show you a few quick studies to corroborate those assertions. So here's a pilot study of dietary fat restriction and flaxseed supplementation in men with prostate cancer before surgery. And prostate cancer is often used as a model of reducing androgens, but flaxseed does reduce androgens. Big surprise there. I wouldn't have that in my diet. The effects of macronutrients on reproductive hormones in overweight and obese men, a pilot study. What you see in this study is that polyunsaturated fatty acids actually lowered testosterone. That's not a good thing. Those are things like the omega-6, linoleic acid, and seed oils, which are corn, canola, safflower, sunflower, etc. So again, as if all of the previous discussion I'd had on seed oils wasn't enough, if you want a healthy amount of testosterone, you probably don't want to have significant amounts of seed oils in your diet. And these things hide. You can watch my content on Instagram, TikTok, wherever. These things are in a lot of foods that you wouldn't expect them to be in, these seed oils. You can see here in a similar study relationships between types of fat consumed and serum estrogen androgen concentrations in Japanese men that polyunsaturated fat consumption was inversely correlated with serum total testosterone after controlling for age, energy, body mass index, alcohol, smoking status. This correlation was statistically significant for polyunsaturated fat. So more polyunsaturated fat, lower serum total testosterone in Japanese males aged 43 to 88 years. You can see here on YouTube if you want the actual reference of that study. Here's an interesting one. The effects of peppermint teas on plasma testosterone, follicle stimulating hormone, and luteinizing hormone levels, FSH, follicle stimulating hormone, and LH, luteinizing hormone, are the pituitary signals to the testicles to produce testosterone and other androgens. And this is in testicular tissue in rats. You want to have any guesses as to what happens? It says that the herbs have some quote unquote toxic effects in these rat testicles. They say follicle stimulating hormone, luteinizing hormone levels had increased and total testosterone levels decreased in experimental groups compared with control groups, meaning that the pituitary was trying to work harder to get those little rat testicles to make more testosterone because they were not producing as much testosterone when they had the peppermint tea. So I wouldn't be drinking that before you go to bed, men or women, if you value your sex hormones. Spearmint induced hypothalamic oxidative stress and testicular anti-androgenicity in male rats. Same sort of thing. Spearmint can lower the conversion of precursor hormones to active androgens in these rats. I don't think I'd be consuming these things. Another thing we know is that trans fatty acids are consistently inversely related to total sperm count in healthy young men. What are trans fats? These are things like partially hydrogenated oils. They show up in the worst of the worst junk food because they've been mostly removed from the food supply. But if you've heard me talk about this on social media, we know that seed oils contain significant amounts of trans fat. This is just part of the process of making seed oils when you are bleaching and deodorizing and making canola, corn, sunflower, safflower oil, you're going to have significant amounts of trans fat in that oil. The FDA says you can put 0 grams of trans fat per serving if it's less than 0.5 grams of trans fat per serving, but you could be right up to 0.5 grams of trans fat. And then if you're eating multiple tablespoons of these oils a day, you're getting gram quantities of trans fat in your diet. That could definitely be hurting your sperm quality and affecting the fertility of both men and women. So be aware that these seed oils are just very unstable. The effects of soy and whey protein supplementation on acute hormonal responses to resistance exercise in men. Our findings demonstrate that 14 days of supplementation with soy protein does appear to partially blunt serum testosterone. That's not good. I would not be using soy protein if you're trying to gain muscle, my friends, men or women. Fatty acid intake in relation to reproductive hormones and testicular volume among healthy young men. So they say that the intake of omega-6 polyunsaturated fatty acids and trans fatty acids inversely related to testicular volume. And while having larger testicles may not be something that seems important to you, men, that testicular volume is often an indication of how well those testicles are working and making those hormones. Who knows? Maybe testicular volume is something you're proud of. I mean, AC/DC talks about this kind of stuff. So who knows? I wouldn't want my testicles to be shrunken by excess seed oils. You make your own decisions there. Now, what can you do on the positive side for your testosterone? I've done entire podcasts on this. There is pretty good evidence that saturated fat supports sex hormone production. And as I hinted at earlier, I want to show you a study showing that sugar can also improve these metrics. Yes, I said it, but look at this study. So the title of this study is Human Sperm Displays Rapid Responses to Diet. And if you look at the abstract, what you find is that this is a moderate size study, I believe, of 15 males, and they put them on a healthy diet for a couple of weeks. And then they added 375 grams of sugar on top of that healthy diet. And what happened? Their sperm quality got better. The sperm quality got better with 375 grams of sugar. So you can see here, average 375 grams of sugar per day on top of a quote healthy diet in these men led to improved sperm metrics. You can see here in this graph, some of the sperm metrics, sperm motility, increasing sperm mass overall, triacylglycerides in sperm, suggestive of increased sperm quality. So there is evidence that you will never hear about in the media that sugar, and again, I don't see the point in eating white sugar unless you're starving and you can't afford anything else. Why not just eat honey or something that has other chemicals that appear to be beneficial, nitrate precursors, prebiotic compounds in it, or fruit? This is probably how I would get my sugars, but no one will tell you that increasing your carbohydrates will improve your sperm quality, men. And there's a lot of talk that the contrary will be true without a lot of good evidence. So it's an interesting thing. I'm sure many people will lose their mind in the comments over that study, but I don't know. It certainly makes me feel less concerned. Not that I really have any concern about eating a significant amount of honey per day, but as I've talked about in the past, increasing carbohydrates will improve your recovery from intense exercise. I want to be ready to skate and surf the next day as much as possible. And as a young, I guess, relatively young male who is still in his fertile years and would like to have children someday and enjoys fertility and libido and vitality, I am interested in supporting that however I can. And if that is including more carbohydrates in my diet, I'm fine with that because honey is delicious. And as I've talked about in the past, honey doesn't induce insulin resistance. Clearly, I have no problems with fasting insulin, et cetera. And as I'll show you in my blood work right now, my uric acid is always just fine. So anyone saying that fructose, carbohydrates in honey or fruit lead to elevated uric acid is missing the story. They're just flat out wrong. Elevated uric acid is insulin resistance until proven otherwise. And I have shown repeatedly on my blood work that no matter how much fructose I eat, my uric acid stays about the same. You can see here my August blood work uric acid was 4, and on this blood work, it was 4.3. So all of the uric acid, fructose fear-mongering just really needs to die. And I've done a whole podcast and can do more in the future about uric acid and gout and how fructose doesn't really contribute to this at all. It is underlying insulin resistance. While we're on this page of my blood work, you can see the uric acid there, and I will show you that my GGT, which is a good indicator of liver health or damage, is just fine at 20. If I had NAFLD, I would probably have an elevated GGT. I'll show you my AST and ALT in a moment. On the previous podcast with my friend Dave Asprey, he claimed that fructose raises triglycerides, but my triglycerides consistently remain 67 or 72. I wonder what Dave's are. And to point out here, in all fairness, let's just say that I do want to show my blood work, and I wish that more health influencers would do the same. I wish that people in the keto community would show their blood work at the level that I'm showing it here and corroborate their assertions. And I wish that people like Dave would show their blood work to show that their triglycerides are so much better than mine. Again, I'm friends with Dave. This is the most friendly way of sort of responding to his criticisms. And, you know, one thing that also came up with Dave in that podcast was hemoglobin A1C. So I'll show that my hemoglobin A1C here is 5.3. It's even gone down since November, where it was 5.4. This is approximately an average blood glucose of maybe 106. And as you can see in my comprehensive metabolic panel up here, my fasting glucose is quite low. Fasting glucose was 80. You can see the rest of this comprehensive metabolic panel. So why do we care about hemoglobin A1C? It's an average blood glucose over the last 90 days. I think it's a fairly inaccurate test. I don't love it, but people talk about it a lot. So I get it and I show it to you guys. Why do you care about a comprehensive metabolic panel? It'll show you your electrolytes at the level of your blood. These are all tightly regulated. It gives you some indication of your kidney function, your BUN, which is sort of a nitrogen balance. You can see here my fasting glucose is 80. My BUN was 23. Again, I end up being often a little dehydrated for these. If people do see an elevated creatinine when they're eating meat, get a cystatin C, which is another way to assess your kidney function, but I'm not worried about mine. My BUN to creatinine ratio is a little high because I was a little dehydrated. Serum sodium, potassium, again, these are tightly regulated. Chloride, carbon dioxide, often people who are doing ketogenic diets will see their carbon dioxide go down because there is some degree of sort of low-level metabolic acidosis. Serum calcium is not a great indicator of calcium status, but PTH is, and I got parathyroid hormone on this blood work, so I'll show you that. And I think you should get PTH on your blood work. Protein total, albumin total, globulin, these are really indications of nutritional status, but are high level. If you're eating food and getting enough calories, these should be fine. Bilirubin is going to be connected with either hemolysis of red blood cells. You only see bilirubin elevated if there's a problem with the gallbladder or a lot of your red blood cells are having issues. Alkaline phosphatase is a strange metric that sometimes has to do with problems, again, with the gallbladder or liver, or biliary tree. No indications there. These should not be elevated unless there's a major problem. But I do want to point out that AST and ALT, these are two things that are technically called liver enzymes, but are more generic than that. It's aspartate aminotransferase and alanine aminotransferase. ALT is more specific for liver. If you have problems with your liver, ALT will likely be elevated. If you see your ALT creeping up, or if it's elevated above the reference range, then you might want to check for something like NAFLD, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. I think the chances that I have any degree of steatosis in my liver are essentially exceedingly rare with an AST and ALT of 25 and 23, respectively. You can see the previous ones are about the same level. And as I mentioned, the GGT, the gamma glutamyl transferase, is a good indicator of liver stress or oxidative stress. It's also low. I do think it's useful to get a urinary panel. And you can see my urinary pH is 7.5, previously 9. Interestingly, I will point out that when I was on a ketogenic carnivore diet, my urinary pH was always low. Your blood pH will not change significantly if you are eating only meat. But I do think that there's a benefit to eating foods with alkaline minerals like more potassium, magnesium, et cetera, this mostly being fruit for many of us, though vegetables would qualify as alkalinizing foods. I don't think those are the best ways to get those alkaline minerals in any way, shape, or form because of the plant defense chemicals that come with them. If you're curious for a deeper dive there, listen to the previous podcast with Sally Norton on oxalates. And I will tell you a story about my experience with oxalates at the end of this podcast. So check your urinary pH. It should really be in this range. If it's too low, then you really do need more alkaline minerals in your diet. Again, your blood pH won't change. I don't think there's any problem with eating, quote, acidic foods like meat. Your body can buffer these, and other alkaline minerals in your diet can buffer these. And those don't cause cancer either. That's a future podcast, or I've done it in the past a million times. Sometimes if you are dumping oxalates, you will see oxalates in the urine. And I will talk about those again at the end of this podcast. I want to point out that for some reason, we ordered ADMA, asymmetric dimethyl arginine, and at least just say that mine is below 100, which is the reference interval but that's the healthiest level you can get for a cardiovascular risk. When I show my lipids, I just want to use this to sort of build a foundation around the fact that I'm metabolically healthy, despite the fact that if you just looked at my lipids, you might be concerned, or a mainstream physician might be concerned. This is just my ongoing argument that lipids are often misinterpreted. So just know that my ADMA is 92. It's within the healthy range, despite the fact that I eat lots of saturated fat and my LDL is above the reference range. So I'll show you that, guys, in a moment. LH and FSH are pituitary hormones that, again, stimulate the testicles or ovaries, depending which set of sex glands you have. Prolactin, we talked about earlier. And PTH, I can show on the next lab. For some reason, they weren't done on these. You want your PTH to be really pretty low. I would say the lowest quartile. And if you're not getting calcium in your diet, you should be getting calcium in your diet to balance phosphorus. I'm getting calcium from dairy and cheese. If dairy doesn't agree with you, try raw dairy, try goat's milk dairy, try fermented dairy if you're lactose intolerant. I think most people could eat dairy if they found high enough quality dairy. Raw cheese is more available than raw milk, but there is a website, realmilk.com, if you're looking for raw milk near you. If you absolutely won't do dairy, don't do oat or almond. I'm not a fan of that at all. Do something like Bone Matrix from Heart and Soil Supplements, which is ground up grass-fed bone, microcrystalline hydroxyapatite. There's calcium in there. It comes with phosphorus, but there's more calcium than phosphorus in microcrystalline hydroxyapatite. Or you can do things like eggshells for calcium. We did get a PSA on this test. If you're a man, it's probably worth getting a PSA. Maybe I should celebrate the fact that my prostate is just fine, at least according to the PSA. I don't know. I wouldn't expect it to be any different. Meat has not enlarged my prostate, for those of you who are skeptical of that. IGF-1 is 177. Many would say that with all the meat I'm eating and with all of the dairy that my IGF-1 would be higher, but my IGF-1 is fine. And IGF-1 is beneficial for humans because it's an anabolic type growth factor, which is important if you want to retain muscle mass. And we know that loss of muscle mass is one of the key indicators or precursors of fragility and death eventually. My reverse T3 was a little high on this blood work. I'll show you my full thyroid labs in a moment. Probably that's an indicator of poor sleep. My vitamin D is 59, probably because I was out of the sun while I was traveling in the United States. I hate that. My LP little A, it does vary. I mean, look at this, 31 to 48. People will say LP little A doesn't change that much, but my LP little A was a little higher. Again, it's still below what's considered to be the trigger for the reference interval. And LP little A, we know, goes up when you eat polyunsaturated fatty acids. It's some sort of an indicator of oxidized LDL, but mine is still just fine eating lots of saturated fat. My C-reactive protein was 0.74. This is an HSCRP. This is always a little higher when I'm in the States because I'm working out and lifting weights. I just surf when I'm in Costa Rica. So every time I lift weights, I get a little bit of soreness. That can raise your CRP. Do not check a CRP after you've done a marathon, after you've done a hard workout. If you're very sore from any of those things, you will have an elevated CRP. I remember a few years ago, I posted blood work when I went on Joe Rogan's podcast and my CRP was probably 2 or something. And that was because I did a really hard workout and my legs were super sore. I subsequently rechecked it and it's always been less than 1. But people were pointing out that my CRP was super high. This is the problem with showing my labs. It allows people to just criticize what I'm doing, but I'd rather put it out there. My TMAO is always around 9.4. I've done previous podcasts on TMAO. TMAO is not harmful for humans, guys. It is reverse causality, is the fact that it's associated with increased cardiovascular disease, because in kidney disease or in insulin resistance, TMAO goes up. So it looks like TMAO is bad because it's consistently associated with more cardiovascular disease, but there's zero good evidence in humans that TMAO is directly causal. It means I'm eating meat, and it means the carnitine and the choline in that meat are being converted somewhat to TMAO in my gut by bacteria. I don't worry about this at all. I've seen it high and low in humans. It's just basically a signature of my gut flora and the fact that I'm eating choline. Sometimes TMAO is high in vegetarians. Again, this is one of the worst metrics. I put it on there just to show you guys how much bullshit it is. And I should point out that there's more preformed TMAO in fish than there is in the corresponding amount of choline and carnitine in a similar amount of meat. So if fish is harmful for humans, then all of the epidemiology we have is very confusing and doesn't make any sense. Again, here's my uric acid. My homocysteine is lower. It's 10.9 now because I've been eating a little more liver. I'm still eating about 1/2 ounce a day to 1 ounce a day. I expect that to keep going down. Again, if you can't get fresh liver at that level, just get something like Heart and Soil Desiccated Organs which will be significantly helpful for you. That's about the labs. On this one, I have another blood work I can show you as well. I did thyroid antibodies. Those are not interesting. Fibrinogen activity is a measure of clotting and some sort of inflammation. We talked about insulin. My TPO antibodies are low. I've never really had autoimmune thyroid disease. You can see here my free T3 is 2.8. You should get free T3 and free T4. Know what's going on with your TSH and your thyroid. That's a key thing that you'll see change with ketogenic or low-carb diets, often in the wrong direction. My magnesium and RBC is 4.2. That's a good measure of magnesium overall stores. I get a lot of magnesium from coconuts. In the Chronometer podcast, I talked about the best animal sources of magnesium. There's tons. I get more than the RDA of magnesium a day from milk, from orange juice, from coconuts, and bananas. We talked about sex hormone binding globulin, and that's the end of that blood work. You can see here the TSH 1.03, T4 free 0.99. We can wrap up with the rest of the blood work here and talk a little bit about lipids. So again, on the previous blood work panel from the 6th of March, my LDL was about 170. Then I did a blood work on the 18th of March and my LDLP is significantly higher. Again, you can see the LDL calc there is 207. So LDL will vary day to day. And because I have an LDL of 207 on this one, previously 160, I even had a blood work panel in November, I think, where my LDL was 130, I'm going to have an elevated, quote, LDL particle number. Now, I've done many, many podcasts about why I don't believe the LDL particle number is the end-all and be-all. I don't believe that ApoB-containing particles, chylomicrons, which are ApoB48, LDL, VLDL, et cetera, are inherently atherogenic. And I've asked the question, if they are inherently atherogenic, then why don't we get atherosclerosis in veins? And I haven't heard a good answer for that. The answer that I hear is that we don't get atherosclerosis in veins because there's less pressure in veins. Well, of course there's less pressure in veins because they're in the venous circulation versus the arterial circulation, but it's that pressure in the arteries that damages the endothelium. And that's what causes the beginning of atherosclerosis when the healing of the endothelium is impaired, as it is when we're insulin resistant. There's really no evidence that a higher pressure in arteries pushes ApoB particles into the subendothelial space. That process is an active process by which LDL must move across the endothelium. And we know that macrophages do not take up native LDL. That is, if an LDL particle or any other ApoB-containing particle gets into your subendothelial space and is not oxidized, macrophages will not take that up. And macrophages must engulf oxidized LDL particles to make foam cells, which are the beginning of a fatty streak and atherosclerosis. So I believe that LDL is part of a healing process in those arteries, and perhaps LDL is moved into the subendothelial space in an active way, but that I really remain unconvinced, and I've talked about this at length on previous podcasts, about that LDL and ApoB are directly atherogenic. It is all about the context, which you can understand by knowing how insulin sensitive you are. That was why I started this podcast with the very first metric of a fasting insulin. So again, I don't know that it's worth going through this NMR panel. My small LDLP is high because a fraction of your LDL will be small. And if you have more LDL than is expected or fit meets the reference range, you will trigger a high small LDL. Most of the cholesterol metrics are indicators of insulin resistance. So we're using a poor secondary metric to get a sense of insulin resistance. In fact, if you look at this, this NMR profile even gave me a lipoprotein insulin resistance score, and it scored me high when we absolutely know that my insulin resistance is not existent because my fasting insulin is low. And my argument here is that these NMR profiles are, they're too sensitive. They're not specific enough for what we are looking for. So by too sensitive, I mean, they're giving all sorts of triggers and saying there's lots of cardiovascular risk when I don't believe there's any real good correlation or indication of cardiovascular risk with what it's showing me here. I think there are much better indicators of cardiovascular risk, specifically things like elevated triglycerides, elevated fasting insulin, and overall insulin resistance and metabolic health. So if you look back at my lipid panels, again, my LDL was 130, 160, 207. It varies a lot day to day. And I think that it is high, quote unquote, because I eat lots of saturated fat and animal foods, dairy, cheese, meat, organs, and very little polyunsaturated fat. We know that according to this homeoviscous model and other compelling theories that there's pretty good evidence that when you eat more saturated fat, your LDL goes up. And all physicians worry about this because we're all sort of sold on this false, fake paradigm that ApoB is inherently atherogenic. I don't believe it is. I think that LDL is not a problem unless you are insulin resistant. And LDL is not even a problem in itself. It just gets wrapped up in the process of arterial healing. Again, this is contrary to the mainstream perspective, and I hope to have some direct, clear debates with people who feel the opposite way. But so far, those people have not been willing to discuss this, which is pretty sad and quite frustrating. And I've even tagged those people on Twitter and gotten no responses. You can see my CBC here, which is a complete blood count showing that even with all of this phlebotomy, my hematocrit is still 51.4. A CBC is a measure of your red blood cells and your immune cells, your white blood cells. It's unusual to see anything out of the ordinary here. You may see anemia. If you see an elevated hematocrit, you might be dehydrated like I often am on these tests. I just need to drink more water before I go in. Or you might actually need to look into your iron as I did. But you can see here the different fractionations of these different types of cells are all within normal. And if there were any problem, you would see these out of the normal ranges. But generally, physicians will do a CBC and a Chem7 for most people. And these are just sort of high-level screening tests. They're not going to be granular enough to get into the real issues. Again, we talked about the testosterone. Here's the PTH of 25. It's definitely in probably the lower quartile of the reference range, suggesting that I'm getting plenty of calcium in my diet. Know what your PTH is. We talked about the prolactin and the insulin. And that's pretty much all of my blood work. So where does this leave us? Again, I've shown my blood work multiple times over the last few months to suggest that I believe that I'm a very healthy human eating foods that many people believe are not healthy for humans. Eating significant amounts of red meat, which doesn't cause inflammation, doesn't elevate my uric acid, doesn't make me insulin resistant, doesn't make me fat, and leads to robust testosterone, good sex drive, and overall health and longevity. Perhaps we'll see. Vitality, although I would put my longevity up against anyone. I will compete in the Centenarian Olympics with anyone out there. And other foods that people think are not healthy. Sugars, honey. I'm not insulin resistant. I don't have high triglycerides. There's no evidence of NAFLD. And as I'll show you in a moment, there's really no evidence that fructose even contributes to NAFLD. So I have low inflammation. I am very insulin sensitive. My lipids are, in my opinion, just fine with low triglycerides, robust HDL. Yes, my LDL is higher than normal, which leads to high, quote unquote, small LDL. But I'm very insulin sensitive. I have a pattern A lipids, meaning my particles are large and buoyant. So there is not really any indication of problem there, in my opinion, other than the elevated LDL. And I think that the hyper-focus on this is myopic and misses the context which we must be considering here, which is insulin sensitivity. And again, hopefully we'll get more conversations around that in the future, actual debates, so that you guys can hear both sides of the issue. But that requires people who disagree with these views actually showing up. We'll see. We'll cross our fingers, respectfully. So let's just end with a discussion of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. This is a fascinating article showing that excessive gluconeogenesis causes hepatic insulin resistance paradox and its sequela. The sequela, which is a fancy word for the downstream effects, are non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. Well, what causes excessive gluconeogenesis? Insulin resistance causes excess GNG. So it's not fructose causing fatty liver disease, it's elevated cortisol, insulin resistance, and then you get fatty liver disease. Let's go further down that rabbit hole. So here's a study in rats suggesting that it's dietary fat stimulating the development of NAFLD more potently than dietary fructose in Sprague Dolly rats. Any guesses as to the type of dietary fat they're using? Well, it's a mixture of saturated and polyunsaturated, but it's mostly garbage polyunsaturated seed oils in rats. And we know that when you give rats or mice fructose, they do much higher levels of de novo lipogenesis, which is the conversion of fructose into fat in the liver. Humans do that to a very, very low extent. There's really no evidence that fructose raises triglycerides in humans. So here's a study. High sucrose intake ameliorates, that is, improves the accumulation of hepatic triacylglycerol, which is liver fat, promoted by restraint stress in young rats. So basically they tie a bunch of young rats up. We know that if you stress rats out, you get non-alcoholic fatty liver disease in the rats. Consistent with humans, it's cortisol that is causing excess gluconeogenesis leading to NAFLD, but you give them sugar and the fatty liver gets better. So tell me again how sugar promotes non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And again, yes, it's a study in rats, but do we really believe the physiology is that different? Cortisol and fatty liver, researchers find the cause of severe metabolic disorders. Yes, it is cortisol, not fructose, that causes fatty liver disease. And guess what? A ketogenic low-carb diet raises cortisol. So the question should really be, how many of the people in the ketogenic community who are all very intelligent and well-intentioned have some degree of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease? I propose that we all do liver ultrasounds and we settle the issue just so that everyone can understand and be as healthy as possible. Here's a study, fructose, high fructose corn syrup, sucrose, and non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And what we find is that the available evidence is not sufficiently robust to draw conclusions regarding the effects of fructose, high fructose corn syrup, or sucrose consumption on non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, meaning that it doesn't really look like fructose is that bad. Excess dietary fructose does not alter the gut microbiota or permeability in humans. Just in case you were wondering, people have often correlated intestinal permeability and gut microbiota changes with NAFLD. That's a randomized controlled pilot study in humans. Dietary fructose did not cause those problems. Higher fructose intake inversely associated with the risk of NAFLD in older Finnish adults, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. Again, that's epidemiology, but the association is not there. And this is the effects of dietary fructose, sucrose, and lactose in the induction of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease in the rat. The takeaway is that they didn't cause it. They didn't cause it. So where is the evidence that fructose causes non-alcoholic fatty liver disease? I don't know. But I think it's pretty easily settled by, I like this idea of serial ultrasounds. Like, let's just get liver ultrasounds of a bunch of people in the health space. I'd like to see some keto folks get liver ultrasounds. I'd like to see some folks that believe that they are in doing well in the longevity space get liver ultrasounds. I'd like to see people who believe that ApoB causes atherosclerosis get liver ultrasounds. And we'll just compare the amount of liver fat for all of us. And that'll be a good metric, at least some indication of what's going on here. So, and I mean this as respectfully as possible. I think that a lot of health influencers, nutritionists, physicians can argue round and round about studies, but let's just actually try and put some legit clinical outcomes on the table so that people can see how healthy any type of dietary strategy is. That's why I show my blood work in podcasts like this, because I want to show as much beyond a shadow of a doubt that what I'm doing creates health, or you can evaluate my labs according to your ideas, and perhaps you would disagree with that. But I'm showing you all what eating an animal-based diet does to blood work. And of course, yes, it will raise LDL, but it will make you very insulin sensitive. For me, it's low hsCRP, high testosterone, and pretty great overall vitality as a 45-year-old. So that's why I'm showing these things. And I think that any human who wants to exist in the nutrition space and offer ideas should be willing to show what their health is to kind of corroborate what they're suggesting may be healthy, in the hopes that we can just understand better. And yes, there is inter-individual variation, but I don't think it's as great as many people believe it is. So in summary, what labs do I think you should get? Start with things like a CBC and a comprehensive metabolic panel. Make sure you're getting a fasting insulin. Get a PTH, get a full thyroid panel with TSH, probably antibodies, free T3, free T4. Get testosterone, free testosterone, sex hormone binding globulin, LH, FSH, get a prolactin, get DHT, get estrogens, which is estradiol predominantly, though estrone may also be valuable. Get a prolactin. I said that, get a progesterone, get pregnenolone if you want, get cortisol, get DHEAS. We talked about that ratio. Get hsCRP, get liver enzymes. Those will be in the comprehensive metabolic panel. Get a lipid panel and understand what that's doing. If you're really concerned, get a coronary artery calcium scan or a CT coronary angiogram. I've had a coronary artery calcium scan in the past, which the score was zero. I probably should repeat that in the near future, and I will share you guys the results of that. I don't believe I have any significant atherosclerosis happening in my arteries. And I think those are the major labs you want to get. Get a PTH. Don't forget about that one. What else did I miss? I mean, I went through all the blood work in the podcast. You guys can see what I'm showing there. So hopefully that helps you understand how to think about your own labs. Getting your own labs will empower you to understand your own health. One of the reasons I went to medical school was because I hate taking my car to the mechanic. I've never put in the time and effort to understand how my car works, but I didn't want that feeling to be the same when I went to a doctor. I wanted to understand how this machine works, how the machine of my body works. I want to know what's under the hood as best I can so that I can understand how to live as healthily as possible. I think that if we delegate our health decisions, our health paradigms to physicians without understanding their reasoning, then we are essentially flying blind. And if we've learned nothing else in the last few years, the last few decades, though physicians are intelligent and well-meaning, they don't always give us the best health advice. So my hope is that with the work I do here on Instagram and my website, which is CarnivoreMD, that you will be empowered to be curious and understand how to really navigate your own life toward the most optimal amount of health. And I believe we're getting closer. I see it every day. When I go to the United States for this blood work, I meet people every single day when I'm out in public telling me that their psoriasis, their eczema, their acne, their libido, their sleep, their depression, their anxiety, their IBD, Crohn's, ulcerative colitis, their IBS have improved. Eating an animal-based diet or something like it, some type of diet that is essentially focused on animal foods, meat and organs, and looks to some degree of low toxicity index for carbohydrates, avoids spinach, avoids kale, avoids grains, maybe not all the time, but for the most part, and gets the majority of their carbohydrates from things like fruit and honey. Maybe rice is a more benign grain, but I think that you're safest with fruit and honey. So hopefully that's all helpful. See you guys in next week's podcast.